January 18th, 2007. We are the Image Doctors. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
Thanks for joining us again today on Nikonians Talk Radio at podcasts.nikonians.org. And we've got a great show for you guys today. We're going to start off with some listener mail. And Rick just got back from a trip to Europe.
Yep.
And you did some fun stuff with your D200 there.
And we're going to talk a little bit about workflow for that kind of shooting when you're coming back with a lot of images, wanting to produce, you know, what are probably more like snapshots, but maybe a whole bunch of them, and raw conversion and keywords,
what to do
stuff,
when you get
metadata,
swamped with a whole ton of images,
all that kind of good stuff.
Very
a little
cool.
Bit about CS3 in there too.
Excellent. And then we want to spend the last topic discussing an introduction to color management at the suggestion of one of our listeners.
Right. And then you're going to talk a little bit about a tip of the day or the week, or
we still haven't. Anybody wants to give us a name for
the tip of the podcast
or tip of the iceberg or whatever it might be,
yeah,
please send your suggestion to us at talkradio@nikonians.org, because we're completely brain dead when it comes to that. Anyhow, let's start with some listener mail. And we got an email a little while ago, a week or two ago, from Jack Markham. And he says, Jason and Rick, I always have dust on my D200 sensor. Even after a wet cleaning, there are some specks of dust. And he wants to know whether this is what he can do to improve cleaning his sensor.
Yeah, and a little bit of, is it just a part of shooting digital, or can you ever get it really clean? You know, some of those kind of things.
Well, dust is sort of the bane potential bane of digital SLR photography, because it can get in there, and when you change your lenses, and some environments just don't lend themselves to being particularly dust-free, especially if you're an outdoor kind of photographer. But
For whatever reason, you know, we were talking about it earlier, I don't have a big problem with dust. Maybe I change lenses really fast, or I'm very lucky. When I first got my D100, I had some problems with it, but
right,
I've actually never done a wet cleaning on my D2X. We'll talk a little bit about...
Right. Well, I guess the first thing you want to do is, I mean, to be quick about it, I mean, mm-hmm, you want to start off... The funny thing was is that I you have to adjust your standards. If you always shoot... If you rarely shoot above F8, you may never see the dust.
Mm-hmm.
But where is it going to show up? You'll see it in a clean blue sky or something like that, where you've stopped down to F11 or F16, and now all of a sudden things are coming into focus, and you see it in every single shot in the same spot. So then you know you have dust on your sensor.
Yeah. And, well, and first, a little bit, but what does it look like?
It's a little out of focus blob.
Yeah, that's just a little
spot.
Bit darker than the surrounding area. It's not black or anything like that. It's, you know, generally speaking, just a little bit darker.
Yeah. And there it, and you'll see it in the exact same spot on all of your images, and that's usually the key when you're reviewing them quickly. If you're going through using a browser and you're forwarding through each thumbnail and you see the same spec showing up as you zip through your images, you'll know that you have an issue. Now, the first thing I would say is, before you even get there, is to mitigate dust in the first place. And the way you can do that is by keeping the rear elements of your lenses clean. Blow those off with a blower brush or a blower.
Right, so the dust doesn't fall off the back of the
right.
lens and onto
Clean
the
sensor. Clean the rear lens caps of your lenses once in a while. Blow those out. Make sure there's no dust accumulating in them. If you change lenses in the field...
Or even wash them out under a faucet.
Yeah, I mean, they're just plastic. You can do that. When you get to the point of changing lenses in the field, you can turn your camera upside down so that dust isn't, you know... Hey, have gravity work with you.
Yeah, make sure you're not pointing it into the wind.
Mm-hmm. Little things like that, to try to keep dust out of the chamber.
Have the replacement lens ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And those are things that I do.
And sometimes that's harder to do than depending on the situation. Now, if you've done all that, but you still end up with a piece of dust on your sensor, what you need to be able to do is, most of the Nikon cameras have a mirror lockup sensor cleaning mode. That is, and if you read the manual on your camera, they say to just blow it out with a good blower.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first thing that you should try to do, because then you're not touching your sensor with anything.
Yeah. And a good one is the Giotto Rocket.
Yeah, the
and
rocket
blower.
And there's
some clones that are out there now, too. But the main thing is that...
It's big.
When you it's fairly big, and it produces a nice, strong stream of air.
And one of the nice things about the rocket blower, too, is that it has an inlet on one side and a one-way valve in there.
Right.
So you're not sucking in dust from the potentially from the chamber and blowing it back in.
Yeah, and actually, that's all I've ever used on my D2X so far, and I've had it a year and a half.
That's my first line of defense.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is I'll do that. I'll take another picture, stop all the way down. And the thing is, if you can't see the dust, again, with the standards, if it's a speck of dust that you can only see them at F22, I don't care about those.
Yeah.
But if I can see them at F4, I care about those, mm-hmm, because those are going to show up in my images more likely. So there's different degrees of cleaning. I mean, you're never going to get every little tiny speck of dust off your sensor, but there's some that are so small you'll never notice them and never see them. You just can't freak out about them.
Yeah, and just from my own standpoint, I'm not into the, you know, shoot test targets and at F22 all the time and see if I can find a speck of dust on the sensor. What I try to do is, am I seeing it in my photos?
Right. That's exactly what I worry about, frankly. Your standard should be in line with what you're seeing on
Otherwise,
your
you could just drive yourself nuts.
The anal retentiveness can be kind of...
Yeah, try to avoid that.
Yeah, obsessive compulsive disorder with your sensor is a bad thing. Okay, now if for whatever reason the rocket blower technique doesn't work, maybe you've got something that's stuck on there a little bit better. Escalating the next level, I would suggest using one of these sensor brushes that are out there. And there's a bunch of them from different companies. But the idea behind them is that when you take a nylon or other kind of bristle brush, real soft bristles, and you blow canned air through it, it's going to develop a slight static charge and dust is going to cling to it.
Mm-hmm.
So... contrary to popular belief, I don't subscribe to the theory that the brush needs to be hundreds of dollars for it to work, because if you're careful, you can actually just use an artist brush on it. But I use one that's less expensive, but there's a whole bunch out there, and they all seem to work pretty well and pretty good results. So there's some ideas. We'll give you some links on the website for some places where you can... Mm-hmm. purchase that, different brushes. And then lastly, if that doesn't work, you could attempt a wet cleaning.
Yeah.
And that usually involves a little bit more complicated. It's using either a swab that you've bought from third party, like I think Photographic Solutions makes some swabs. They're pretty expensive. But they, a piece of fabric wrapped around a plastic spatula.
I've got at home, although like I said, I haven't used them in a while, are the PEC pads.
Right. That's real non-abrasive.
And
usually pure methanol, which is like something that you can't ship via air.
Yeah.
So there may be issues for our European listeners ordering Eclipse from the United States. It's made by Photographic Solutions. And because it's methanol and it's extremely flammable and volatile, you can't. But you're just looking for pure methanol. And the trick with doing a wet cleaning is to... not use too much liquid.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take more than about a drop of the methanol to actually work. So, and that does take some time. And I find that sometimes I can create more dust specks with my wet cleaning. And there's people who get really good at it, and it's not too hard. You're not going to break your sensor unless you somehow flood it with methanol. And if you do those steps properly, that won't happen. But that's the least frequent of what I usually do.
But to just reinforce what we talked about earlier, try to take the non-OCD approach on this.
Yes.
If you're not seeing it in your shots that you're making, don't worry about it.
Yes. So that's what we think about sensor cleaning. Like I said, we'll put some links up to some places that have tutorials and stuff for sensor cleaning.
Yeah.
But it's a good topic and one that comes up quite frequently.
Yep. So thanks, Jack, for the suggestion.
Yeah. So, Mr. Jetlag, you just got back from Europe.
Yeah, I am very jet-lagged at this point.
And so remind me where you went.
It was a pretty cool trip. Went to Vienna and were there for several days, followed by Prague and a little town outside Prague, and then over to Budapest for several days. And then on the way back to Vienna, where we flew out of, we stopped in Bratislava in Slovakia for just a few hours, really. Just a quick train stop. But it was a blast. A lot of fun.
That's cool. I wish I could have been there. That sounds like you had a really good time. Now, what you were sort of agonizing over what you were, I remember.
You
were going to do black and white on this trip, and you were trying to figure out how you wanted to do it. And
well, for a while, I've wanted to shoot something like that, you know, just in black and white, be real, very purist about it. And I was, what I was planning to do until just a few days before I left, actually, was shoot with a medium format rangefinder camera. Just for fun, just to punish myself, I think.
I mean, you said, wait, I'm going on vacation. Why should I punish myself?
Well, what it really came down to is if I'd been going to places that I had shot before and had good familiarity with and it had really exhausted the subjects in a lot of ways, I probably would have gone that route because it would have been kind of fun. But I wasn't in that situation, so I decided to go with something that was more versatile. And
so you brought the pinhole camera.
I brought the Quaker Oats pinhole camera. That worked great as long as, you know, no one was moving around or anything. But now I took the D200, mm-hmm. Which worked great, and I took I think I mentioned in a previous podcast not too long ago, I picked up a used 18-70. Mm-hmm. Just because it's so darn small and it was cheap as heck.
And it's a real versatile focal length range too.
Oh, great, great little lens. I was really pleased with it. It was just a pleasure to use. Great sharp results from it. Really nice. You know, I think if you have a 17-55 2.8 like we both do, you know, those are great lenses, but gosh, are they big and heavy.
Yeah, they really are.
So when you're, you know, doing the travel kind of stuff, the 18-70 is just wonderful. And I got mine for like $175 in mint condition. No complaints. It worked great. And I had my 12-24. I had a 10.5 fisheye with me, mm-hmm. you know, just like we talked about in podcast here recently. And those are what I used. I actually had a 35mm F2 that I stuck in my suitcase.
Yeah.
And it pretty much stayed there the whole time. Yeah. I actually never used it on the trip. I thought I would, but just never.
Something a little wider probably would have been more useful.
Yeah, probably so. Probably
like
so.
A 24 maybe or something.
Yeah.
But hey.
And then along with that, I had, you know, polarizer. I honestly didn't use that a lot because there were a lot of overcast skies mm-hmm. this time of year, and it doesn't help much in that situation. But I had a tabletop tripod with me. I didn't bring a big one, just a little tabletop thing. And I use that all the time. Extremely useful. They're great in places like cathedrals. You know, if you're allowed to shoot in the cathedral, it varies, you know, from
so you just stick it on like the pew or on a railing.
You can,
or
on a column. Uh-huh. You know, it doesn't have to be
just
a horizontal one; it can be a vertical one, and lots of other places. So it was very useful. You know, my son and I were doing the traveling, and we did a lot of nighttime stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, shooting things lit up at night.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, and we used it there. But the choice of lenses and stuff worked great, and the D200, just very nice camera. Oh, I had a flash, an SB800,
uh-huh.
but a lot of times I just used the little pop-up. Shot raw, used compressed raw, just for the heck of it, because I wasn't too worried about these images. They were just snapshots, really.
And just as a side, I've gone back and looked more at that.
There's
and
not
I
a
still
big
can't
difference.
Tell any difference between
no.
compressed. So I've gone back just in my own shooting to shoot compressed raw.
Yeah, probably a very practical thing to do. And I actually, you know, brought all the flashcards I had because I figured, why not? They're tiny. Had a little think tank Pixel Rocket.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to get all the shots from the trip on 1 4-gig card.
Oh, very
just
cool.
Barely. I had 2 shots left on it, and I switched to the new card, but never actually.
I could
shot
see that
because
I can fit about 300 shots on a 4-gig card, and
yeah,
on
and
a
I had
vacation,
I had more than 400 on it. Yeah,
that's yeah with a D2, and I'm thinking D2X, so with mm-hmm. a slightly lower resolution of the D200.
Yeah,
that makes about perfect sense. Now, you brought your laptop, right? So
no.
You didn't bring any laptop.
No laptop and no portable hard drive.
Okay, so your workflow on this trip was literally put it onto the cards and whatever I come back with, I will mm-hmm. deal with it later,
mm-hmm.
which is a little different than what we do here when we travel domestically, we usually bring a laptop and
right.
sort of cull out our keepers, or at least go through the day's shots and download them to a back them up to the computer every evening.
Right.
But you didn't do that on this.
No,
so you
I
came
wasn't
back and you had 400 pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So take me through what you did on. I know you haven't finished yet, but what's your workflow been?
Yeah, I'm pretty close to being done, actually. I'm not that far away from it. One of the things that I was thinking about doing, and it's what I did, was, you know, we talked about Photoshop CS3, the beta version of that recently, mm-hmm. and I'd played around a little bit with it, including the new version of ACR, and liked what I saw in ACR. You know, it's got some additional sliders and functions in there, and some of the key ones for the images that I processed on this trip were the fact that you can do highlight recovery as a separate thing from exposure, fill light, vibrance, and then it's got ISO-specific camera defaults, which are nice if you just want to use the noise reduction features within mm-hmm. it, which, you know, aren't super fancy, but they're not bad, mm-hmm. actually, for most images, if you don't have to get fancy. And again, what I was doing in this trip were more snapshot kind of things.
So these were not images that you expected to have to do tons of intensive post-processing.
No, not really.
This is just, I want to make sure that the contrast and the colors look good.
Yeah.
And the sharpness is right, and mm-hmm. move along.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty straightforward stuff. And so we'll talk a little bit more about how that worked in a minute. But in terms of the workflow, what I did is I got home, downloaded the images with Photo Mechanic. We've talked about that one before. Mm-hmm. And prior to starting to download, I had it set up with its stationary pad, that's what they call it, to go ahead and insert keywords and things like that for the trip. Just gross level things that applied for all the shots.
During the transfer process.
Right.
Yeah, and you can do that with Photo Mechanic. It's got right. this option where it can embed IPTC data of your choice.
Right. So captions, it's got things keywords. Like, you know, my name, copyright
right.
stuff. You know, I had stuff for Eastern Europe and junk
like that.
So that
when you do a keyword search for metadata later on, you know that it'll show up.
Yeah, it was the stuff that would be applicable for all the images.
Cool.
That I was downloading. And so did that. Got them into Bridge, you know, brought them up in Bridge, and uh-huh. I used the new version of it, the CS3 version, just for fun, and then started looking through them and doing the selection of images that way. Now, one of the first things I did, in Bridge was add the additional keywords. You know, for example, I was shooting in different cities, so I had keywords in there for Vienna and Prague and Budapest, et cetera.
So you kind of grouped out your
images. Yeah, you know, and so shots that my son was in, you know, I had those labeled too with his name and, you know, similar things like that. So the keywords were put in versus Bridge, and that's very easy to do. It takes very little time, and you can, you know, select multiple images and tag them all with the keywords. Did a few more things with metadata, some of the things that I hadn't done with Photo Mechanic just because I had forgotten. I forgot one of the things I used in Photo Mechanic right after I downloaded them. Once again, I forgot to set my clock in my computer, so I had it all wrong. And not that's a big deal.
So you were able to do a global...
just fix it. That was kind of cool. So went through and figured out what I was going to keep as the better images from the trip, and went in and used the star system on those.
Yeah, that works really well.
In Bridge. Yeah. Yeah, it's very easy. I think I ended up with, you know, about 130 or so that, you know, seemed pretty decent and not great works of art. That's not what I was really doing this
trip.
But
it's your photo album from your trip,
essentially. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's just the photo album from the trip. And so those are the ones that I then went into and did some work in ACR. It's like, why screw around on images that you're not going to do anything with? Mm-hmm. Do raw conversion stuff.
So we've gone from 400 now to 135, 140 images.
Yeah.
And these are the ones you actually want to work on.
Right. And, you know, some of the things that I would do if I had multiple shots that all needed the same white balance setting, and maybe it needed to be tweaked a little bit from what it was, mm-hmm. and I just shot using auto white balance, I would use the feature of bringing up multiple ones simultaneously and then, you know, synchronizing them for white balance and stuff like that. Make it easy and then just do individual tweaks in specific images. I mentioned earlier the different control setup in the new version of ACR. I do like that. I think it's a much nicer
step in the right direction.
Set of controls than the original. I found the highlight recovery and fill light features to be particularly nice. They really did do the right things for the images a lot of times. And the ISO-specific defaults were also handy because for these things, I'm just using the very simple noise reduction stuff. And I was shooting everywhere from ISO 100 up to 1600. You know, so pretty wide range.
You had the spectrum going there then.
Yeah. And so I did create some defaults before I really got cranking that loaded in what I thought was appropriate noise reduction.
And I think you're bringing up a good point here with all of the raw converters. You know, this goes for ACR, this, you know, especially for ACR where it gives you just some defaults that aren't based on anything from the camera. Mm-hmm. But even with using Capture NX or the other Bibble or any of these other ones, when you get a setting that you like for the core functions of your image, not something that you would change every time, like white balance, but tone curves and saturation, and you've got something the right way, save yourself the hassle and make
Absolutely.
A preset. Make a preset. I get people emailing
Presets are wonderful.
I get people emailing me about how long it takes to do things, say, in Capture NX. Oh, this is very slow. Because I said, well, you don't honestly believe that I go through and use and tweak individual saturation settings on every image I know I'm going to do it the same way. I have a preset for that.
And I know both of us have very similar presets for NX and a bunch of them.
And you
use
do the same thing with
the
ACR.
Time.
And then bang.
And I've got a boatload in ACR, both the new version and the old version
so
for the same reason. For example, the fisheye stuff. I've got a setting there in ACR to use with the 10.5mm lens that all it does is fix the chromatic aberration. And it's spot
on. Once you've dialed it in.
And then all I have to do is just look through the images, which are the 10.5 ones, tag them all, smack. That setting goes against it. It only affects that, none of the other parameters.
So no matter what raw converter that you're using, most of them have a function of setting some presets up. And you have to learn how to use them, but, I mean, take advantage of that.
Yeah.
Because I can open an image now and have them ready to go or do a batch job even without opening the images and know that what comes out is going to be 90% of the way home without even having opened the image. Mm-hmm. I know that, oh, that was a landscape, and if I apply this settings preset to it, hey, it's going to look all right. It's going to have the saturation that I want and the sharpening that I want and the tone curve that I want.
Right.
So anyway, not to sidetrack you from your workflow story here, but I think that's important in terms of overall big picture stuff to speed things up.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to you're in the browser, you're in Bridge.
Right.
And you've gone through and you've applied batch settings, white balance, and
tweaked all that.
Tweaked all your things. So now, then what did you do?
Well, that's about where I'm at.
Okay.
I mean, I have also moved that stuff into iView Media Pro, which is cataloging software. That's frankly very simple. There's not much to that. It's like import,
Right. And that's something you can do also.
If you have the keywords in there already, it's easy.
I guess it's important to keep in mind, when you bring the photos into your computer from your card or camera or wherever, set up a directory structure that makes sense to you. Subfolders, whatever, keepers. So if you had a folder called Eastern Europe, and then subfolders for each city, or however you wanted to do it, that can be useful so that you can go back and find things later when you're cataloging them. In addition to adding the keywords to individual images, make sure you've organized them. Now, did you make second copies and back any of this stuff up yet, or that's...
Be a good idea.
That would probably be smart, right?
Yeah. I did technically, but it's not in the final form.
So what do you see yourself...
What next?
Where do you see yourself going? I mean, if it were... me sitting there, I'd say, well, there's some that I'm probably going to print. Mm-hmm. There's some that I'm going to make a batch of and put on my website. And then there's some that I'm going to email to my friends and family and say, here we were on our trip.
Right.
So those are three different target destinations.
Yeah, and there's actually a fourth one that I'm going to do that I've done for some previous trips. It's kind of fun. And what it is making a DVD with the images on it that you can, you know, play on a TV. You know, it's not at super high resolution, but it's not bad, actually. It doesn't look bad. And the software that I've got to do that, I think it's called ProShow Gold or something like uh-huh. that. It's a nice little package. Just, you know,
so it just makes a slideshow kind of thing?
Yeah, you basically, you know, can import a directory of JPEGs in there. So when I'm done with all this, I'll have Photoshop spit out a whole bunch of JPEGs
okay.
for the
that was sort of
files
where I was going
that
with
I've
this.
Labeled as the keepers. And then you can put music to it, and, you know, it does dissolves and fades and all that kind of junk. And, you know, it's the thing that's the equivalent of the slideshow where you can torture your friends and family.
And with all due respect to my grandmother, the three-hour China, I'll never forget it as part of my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
The three-hour China slideshow with, could have been four... It was at least three, but maybe more carousels of Kodak carousels
yeah.
of slides. I love you, but it was a long slideshow.
Yeah, I believe in brevity for that. So this won't be
we
that long.
We learned a lot.
But it's kind of a fun thing to do. So.
And I think you can do that if you have, if you're on a Mac like I am, you can use iPhoto or iMovie, and you can make little slideshows out of JPEGs mm-hmm. and then present them on your computer or even mm-hmm. use the and burn them to a DVD, quite possibly. I just never tried it, but that's a
yeah.
it's a good idea. Well, that sounds like fun. Now you're gonna do. You did some black and white stuff.
Not yet.
Okay, but you're gonna do those conversions
I
too.
Think so.
When you get down to it.
I think so.
And then he's gonna be knocking at my door, wanting to use my Epson printer to,
you
to
never
print
know.
Gigantic prints for your.
Yeah,
office.
Except these probably won't be super
I'm
gigantic. These will be smaller ones. they're not that great. They're just fun snapshots.
I had a lot of joy taking that photo today to the frame shop to get framed a 16 by 24 inch print.
Yeah, show off.
So I made you one. Anyway, it's sometimes printing really big is just it's
fun.
What the image ought to be.
Yeah.
And that's very good. And
but yeah, like I said earlier, it was a great trip. Highly recommend those locations, wonderful cities, very beautiful, lots of interesting things. And, you know, I think sometimes people hesitate going other places just because they're different and they think that they'll feel awkward. They might have language problems. I can tell you, if you can understand what we're saying in this podcast, you're not likely going to have language problems in Europe.
Heck, I went to Poland
so
once
easy.
And I survived.
Yeah, now, I mean, I can speak German okay, and I can understand it pretty decently. So, you know, in Vienna, that was fine. But I'll tell you, you didn't need it. It wasn't hard. And it's so easy to get around because the transportation systems are so good. You don't have to worry about rental cars. It simplifies everything. And I think you could almost make a case for it being easier mm-hmm. than doing travel in the U.S., except for the long plane flights.
Yeah, that can hurt your butt. That can hurt your butt.
Yep, but great places to go.
Sweet. All right. Well, it's good to have you back either way, and
yep.
I can't wait to see some of the pictures.
Yep.
We want to spend the last chunk of our time with the basics of color management.
Right.
Because it's a huge topic. And
yeah,
and
we're not going to do that.
The entire series. No, we're not going to do that. And we want to explain sort of the essentials for getting started, why you need it, and if you're going to set up some basic color management strategy, what should you do?
Right.
Because this is another one where you can get obsessive compulsive. We could do a whole show on OCD photographers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and color
and not
management.
Saying that we never stray into that zone, because that would
be very quiet.
But we try not to.
But color management is one of those areas where it's important if you're serious about getting good prints. And that's really where it comes into play for the most part.
It can even be important if you're just putting images on the internet.
Yeah, on the internet and sharing your pictures with friends.
Right.
And the reason, well, I guess let me back up for a second. The number one reason why people start to investigate color management usually is because they have got a nice new digital camera, mm-hmm. and a nice photo printer, because those are so inexpensive now, you know, some fancy, not even expensive, but just a good photo printer. And they make their first print after they slaved over this thing in Photoshop, Elements, or wherever for however long. And this thing comes out of their printer, and it doesn't look anything like what's on the screen.
Right.
Or it's different enough that now you start battling the, well, what do I have to start adjusting here to make this? And you start wasting ink and paper, and you start pulling out your hair, and pretty soon you look like me and Rick with no hair.
Yeah, no hair. But you can even have problems before that. I've seen situations where people bought a new camera. They've got some nice new D70, D80, whatever. And gosh, every single photo it takes is overexposed when they look at it on their computer monitor.
Or underexposed.
And they never actually get to the point of printing it. Yeah, it could be underexposed too.
It's too dark or it's too light.
And it's because the monitor isn't calibrated.
Exactly.
Yeah. The camera's actually producing images that are just fine.
Mm-hmm. So the inherent problem that we have is that digital images, RGB data, is digital. It's numbers. When you get right down to it, it's a set of data, and there are numbers that encode what the image would be color, red, green, and blue values. And all your computer does is it just reads those numbers in, and it spits out that data stream to your monitor, and it asks the monitor to produce RGB data based on that numerical data set. The biggest problem, though, is that your computer cannot see. It doesn't say, monitor, make this green. It just says, monitor, give me a value of XYZ for RGB. If your monitor is off and has a color cast to it, or is too dark or is too light, your computer does not know this when it's telling the monitor.
Right.
It's just saying, produce, you know, light up the phosphors on your screen given this data set.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't see what is being produced.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have asked it to produce, you know, fire engine red, and it's coming out red orange on your screen.
Yeah.
And you don't know if that's because the image was off or the monitor was off.
Yeah. And another way of looking at it is you've got several things all working together, hopefully working together.
Mm-hmm.
Your camera, your computer, your monitor, and your printer. Those are the primary ones, right? And they all have to be talking the same language and working with the same kinds of assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they're not all synchronized up with each other, and that's really what color management is all about, then you'll get unpredictable results. It may be that your camera and your monitor are synced up, in which case you shoot images and they look wonderful on the screen. But if your printer isn't set up correctly, when you go to print, it'll be off. And so all those things have to work harmoniously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what color management is
exactly
all about.
And I would say the core, if you do nothing else, and you don't have to obsess over color management, but if you do nothing else, if you want to have a reasonable color managed workflow, you need to calibrate your monitor.
Yeah.
With a hardware calibrator. There's other ways of doing it by eye, but they're just not.
Yeah.
They're
just
not trust
us on us. This is not some luxury item, some OCD kind of thing here.
It's the theme of the show today.
Yeah. We've talked
about this before.
Yeah.
There's a couple out there, but there's some inexpensive options for calibrating a monitor. And without going into the gory details, you buy a package that has a hardware, it's called a colorimeter, and you hang this thing. It looks like a mouse or a hockey puck, depending on, you know, what brand you get. You hang it in front of your monitor. It connects to your computer, usually over a USB line.
Mm-hmm.
And then this comes with some software that produces color patches. It just makes colors in a box on the screen. Black, white, everything in between, red, green, blue, and all of the shades, where the software knows, because someone's told it, what that color is supposed to look like. you know, that this is blue. And then the colorimeter, the piece of hardware, reads that and says, okay, I know that this number should be blue. I'm reading it off the screen, and it's bluish green. That means we need to correct things. And it does this for a whole series of these patches.
Right.
Now, because you're actually introducing this hardware, the colorimeter is the eyes that your computer can use to see your monitor.
Right.
So now your computer knows it can correlate a numerical RGB value for a particular color with what the monitor actually produces when it's told that.
Yeah, and it really does work, and it does it a heck of a lot better than what you can do by eye.
Right. It's like adding eyeglasses for your computer,
I used
for your monitor.
Adobe Gamma, which is a free...
That free thing, yeah.
Yeah, thing for a long time, thinking, you know, I think I'm getting pretty close just with this, and I can save the money. And that was just foolish. I finally went ahead and got one just because of some inconsistencies that were showing up.
And there's a lot of
different ones
out there.
And then once I got them set, I looked through my old images. Boy, there were a lot of them that were off just for a variety of reasons. And you need to run this thing about once a month or so. That's
just
what
I
do with mine.
Especially with CRT monitors.
And you will see a difference, you know, doing it once a month. But gosh, go ahead and get one of those. They don't have to be expensive ones.
No, they really don't. And there's a bunch of choices out there, and they come with the software, and they literally walk you through step by step on how to do it.
Yeah.
It's not rocket science, but
now
boy,
you can
it helps.
Get equivalent kinds of things for your printer too, where it will scan a printout that's made using a test kind of image for the print.
But
do the same kind of thing. Those are expensive.
And if you get a cheap one that's like, oh, just use your flatbed scanner, it's not going to be very good. It's probably not worth the investment.
And I have not invested in that.
Neither have I.
And I've been okay. I haven't seen any big problems.
Me
so
too,
far.
And I will get into that because here's the next step in the thing. Your color managed workflow. If you've we've now calibrated your monitor, and that just gets stored as a correction factor somewhere in your computer. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about it. It's just there. And if you use a piece of software that is color space aware, it will take that into consideration in your monitor, and it knows. Mm-hmm. It'll change the color output of your monitor too, compared to what you'll see as the last step. It changes the colors, and all of a sudden everything looks very different.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. It just takes a little time to get used to, but it'll be fine. If you use something like Photoshop, Photoshop has the advantage of being able to read a color profile that is associated with an image. So that's sort of the next thing is you can have an image with data, but if those data were generated by one camera or another, how do you standardize colors from camera to camera? And the answer is by using something called a color profile, which is just kind of like a bucket into which all the colors can fit. It's a space, and it's mapped out, and the computer can understand if I have a value of some RGB value and it's mapped to the sRGB color space being one example, it knows how to reproduce that on your screen properly. And Photoshop does this, and it all happens behind the scenes. You don't have to worry about it. The problem comes in is if you send an image to somebody without a color profile associated with it, then your computer has to guess as to what that color space is. And that's where things can get displayed incorrectly between monitors. Or more likely when you're trying to post on Nikonians and you wonder why your image looks flat. The most commonly used color space in post-production is the Adobe 1998 color space.
For professional
workflow. It's a bigger bucket.
Not the most popular one, though.
But the most commonly used one, just generic, is the sRGB color space.
If you're shooting with a point-and-shoot, for example...
That's what comes out.
Chances are it's sRGB.
If you take your pictures to Walmart to get them printed...
sRGB.
It assumes they will be an sRGB. So what you need to... So you can do one of two things. If your image is in a different color space, you need to use Photoshop to convert the profile to the sRGB space or whatever one you want and save that with your image. If you take an image that was shot in Adobe RGB to some other computer and it doesn't know that it was shot in Adobe RGB, it will default to sRGB and it's going to look washed out and flat. Mm-hmm. And that's because sRGB is not as big of a bucket as the Adobe RGB. So things tend to look less saturated. There's just, it's a smaller color space. And so if you had to pick one space, if you were only, if you're going to die tomorrow and you only could shoot one thing and you want the all purpose color space, sRGB would be it, just because that's sort of the universal currency. When you post online on Iconians, most of your web browsers, they don't read color space or color profile, I should say. So it will assume sRGB. So if your image wasn't saved as sRGB, it's going to look wrong. Yeah. It's going to look flat.
Now, both of us shoot in Adobe RGB, and that's what I've used for a long time. Works fine. I do the conversions, you know, when I'm putting something out on the web.
You just have to know that I have to convert this to sRGB first.
But I'll be honest, it's a slightly academic kind of thing, because you can get good results just shooting in sRGB.
In theory, using a slightly wider color space means that when you send it to, say, an inkjet printer, you'll get better results, more tone, because there's just a larger, you know, more colors fit in it.
Yeah.
But that's the theory, and we have to test it. I haven't tested everything.
Yeah, in practice, it's not a huge difference.
No.
So if you just want simplicity, sRGB is not a bad way to go.
Now, with your digital cameras, there is a reason to use Adobe RGB, and that's because you can get more natural-looking color. Because the Nikon cameras have, many of them do not differentiate between the color space and the color mode. Mm-hmm. And we talked about color modes a little bit before, and this really isn't, this is sort of an aside to our color management topic, but color mode in the Nikon cameras is like choosing different film palettes. You'll get different colors rendered between mode 1 and mode 3. If you want the most accurate color, you want to use mode 2. And with the Nikon cameras, mode 2 is only available if you shoot in the Adobe RGB space.
Yeah.
Because that is the space that's big enough to hold all those extra colors. And I
now,
find
is
that
accurate color a good thing? Well, maybe it is.
Yes and
maybe
no.
Maybe it isn't.
It depends
right?
on your subject.
Yeah.
Most I like
films
mode 3
weren't
color.
Accurate. Yeah, we both do.
But there are certain circumstances where if I'm trying to get that true color look, you know, where I'm taking a picture of an object that is a particular color, I want to use mode 2 there because it tends to get it more accurate. It doesn't shift any hues on
me. And for things like portraits, I like using mode 1.
Mm-hmm. I think that looks good too.
Yeah.
So
it's
just a matter of taste. So if you're using like a D70, for example, and you choose mode 1, you're also choosing sRGB space.
And same with mode 3 on that camera.
Exactly. So there are some differences, but those are topics we've sort of already covered a little bit.
Yeah.
Now let's get to the last step in the workflow, which is making that print.
Mm-hmm.
And the fundamental problem that people have between looking at your screen and printing out something on a piece of paper is that before you even worry about the color, you have to understand that those two images are vastly different in the way they are produced and hit your eye. The screen, the computer monitor, is more like looking at a transparency on a light box. It's transmitted light projected onto your eye. A print on paper is light that is being reflected back, and takes into consideration the color of the paper as well. Not to mention that the light the ambient light that is being used to, you know, in the room or if you're outside. So the same print could look different on two different kinds of paper in two different kinds of lighting situations. And the way you solve this is
try to
or attempt to solve this and have the print match the computer screen is to use something called a printer paper profile. And a lot of printers these days, especially the Epsons, will include paper profiles for that printer for a suite of different papers, the matte papers and the luster papers and the glossy papers.
And paper manufacturers will often provide those as well via their websites, and they'll be for a specific printer or set of printers as well. So there, you could have Moab paper for the Epson R2400 like I have, or for a Canon printer, or whatever.
So it's important to have the... And a lot of times, if you go to the website of the manufacturer of the paper or the printer, you can download those profiles for those papers. And this is critical because this paper profile is the decoder ring that tells the...
The secret decoder ring.
It's the secret... Yeah, it's like the Little Orphan Annie decoder ring.
Right.
That tells you... That tells the printer how to interpret the color numbers coming out of the computer. And if you use, again, if you use something like Photoshop to print, which I do, and I know you do, then you can enable the color management from the print, from the Photoshop print with preview dialog, where you tell it to use a particular paper profile when printing. There's a catch, though, that you have to be careful about. If you're going to do that, you need to disable all of the color management settings from your printer driver.
Right.
By default, your printer drivers, they don't assume that you're going to use color management profiles when you buy your printer. So the box that says, you know, set it to photo mode and, you know, vivid quality, all this stuff that there might be in the print settings, you need to disable that.
Right, and let Photoshop
And tell Photoshop to do the color management on its own. Otherwise, what you're doing is the equivalent of if you put in your contact lenses and then put your glasses on.
Right.
You've just double corrected, and now you get a skewy, weird print.
Right, right.
So that's the trick.
Double color management is not twice as good as...
No, it's like two management. Wrongs don't make a right.
Right.
So that's a problem.
Two wrongs make it very wrong.
Right. But I think three lefts make a right.
I can't remember.
Something like that.
Yeah. I'm so jet lagged, I don't remember. So.
As complicated as this sounds to describe, it's really not that hard to do in practice. Mm-mm.
And then you get it set up, and you just leave it there.
And once you're dialed in and set up, it's not terribly hard to do because, you know, if you're like me, you're using one or two different kinds of papers. So you're not, you know, I have 80 different profiles installed on my computer. That's just because that's what came with the driver.
Right.
But I don't need to worry about them.
No. And so, I just run my little spider tool to profile my monitor once a month. And it's got a little alarm thing that comes up and tells me, hey,
right,
you haven't done this in a month. Time to do it.
Right. And okay. I think... I personally don't know how much it changes in a month on an LCD screen. I know that with a CRT that over time, they will change significantly.
I see drift.
Okay.
With the LCD.
It's
about the same amount.
Part of it's going to change, depend on your monitor too, on the display that you have. But it's critical. So the good news is that as complicated as that was, I actually wrote an article on my own website that I'll put a link to that talks about color management. And there's some screenshots in there of the Photoshop print dialog and how you set it up to do that. And it's just really important that if you're going to make nice prints and you want to have things look consistent from computer to computer, a color managed workflow is really important.
Yep.
So that's...
makes things easy. Keeps you from making multiple prints in order to get one good one.
Yeah, the savings in ink is worth it alone.
Yeah,
when you get that dialed in,
plus the frustration,
right,
that you don't have.
And when people email me and they say, "Gosh, you know, I looked at these pictures and they don't look right on my screen. Everything looks bad." The first question I always ask them is, "Are you using a calibrated monitor?" Because if you're not, all bets are off.
Yeah,
you cannot guarantee it unless you baseline your monitor with a calibration hardware. Okay, so since we're almost out of time. Was there anything we have? Oh, the tip of the iceberg, tip of the show,
tip of the podcast.
And this is less of a tip and more of just a sort of a question that comes up. I see a lot and sort of dispel, not really myths or rumors or hearsay, but the question is why should I buy a faster memory card? You see all these 80X cards and 133X cards, and you know it seems like the manufacturers are really pushing the cards. What is that worth? And the answer is, if you're using a recent, and by recent I mean in the last two or three years, Nikon DSLR, so a D70, a D50, any of these cameras, they take advantage of the faster cards to a point, but they've got very good memory buffers, and you're limited less by the card and more by the transfer rate to the, you know, to filling, writing to the buffer in your camera, or dumping the buffer to the memory card, I should say. Faster cards will make a difference up to a point. But where you really see the benefit of a fast memory card is if you use a dedicated card reader to download those images to your computer. And that's where those data transfer rates can be much faster than what's in the camera. And when you're talking about workflows where you're downloading 2 or 4 gigabyte cards, the difference in speed starts to add up.
Yeah.
Being able to download a 4 gig card in 5 minutes versus 10 minutes, that's a major improvement. And I know that like SanDisk just came out with their Extreme 4 cards. Well, the only way you can take advantage of those cards is to use the Extreme 4 reader. So that's where you see the speed boost is on your is in the workflow side when you're transferring files to the computer. And if you're in the field with a laptop and you've got a fast reader and fast cards, that can help a lot.
Yeah,
because you're saving on time.
I think we've both been in situations where we were kind of racing the clock a little bit,
right,
to get
stuff
downloaded.
You want to download cards, and you know, and that's really important. So that's true too. And so if you're going to get a card reader, I would recommend you know, the all-in-one read 17 different card formats reader is probably not your best bet. You're probably going to be better off with one of the dedicated readers for the particular memory card that you use, either compact flash or secure SD, secure digital. Mm-hmm. And some of the manufacturers will make a, like SanDisk or Lexar, will make a reader that's optimized to take advantage of those acceleration features in the cards.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll also want to make sure that you're using a USB 2 or a FireWire reader.
Yeah, otherwise
on top
it's
of it.
Really slow.
If you use a USB 1, if your computer only has USB 1.0 or 1.1, I guess is what it is, your limiting step is not the reader, but the bandwidth of your USB port.
Yeah.
And that's really going to be slow.
Yeah.
So that's just sort of our tip is to, you gain it on the workflow side. You might not see it on the camera side unless you're using really old memory cards. So that's it.
That's the show.
That is the show. Put a wrap on that and go have a beer or something like that now that you're back.
Yep.
Go take some sleep medication or something.
That sounds like a good plan.
All right. Well, again, don't forget to email us your suggestions for show topics. talkradio@nikonians.org. It's been a pleasure again, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yep. Bye-bye.